Well, good evening once again. Let's open up our Bibles to Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12, and let me just remind you men that tomorrow evening we are back in action with the men's fellowship, and a lot of great things happening in that men's fellowship, guys, and if you're not part of it, you ought to be. It's just a great time of encouragement and, building relationships and getting some good godly counsel and accountability. And, I think there are a lot of men out there, quite frankly, as Christians, who are just sort of out there on their own. And so you need to connect with the body. And so the men's fellowship is really... That's a good way to describe what it is, because it's really designed to create an opportunity for you guys to fellowship. So come on out tomorrow night. Join us at 7 o'clock. We're going to have a great time. We're going to be going through some of Paul's epistles, but tomorrow night maybe, just to kick things off, there's so many missionaries and different pastors in town. I think I might just have a few of the out-of-town guys share a few thoughts with us tomorrow night. So anyway, come on out and join us. Friday morning, the ladies are back up and running, and the women's fellowship tomorrow night as well, meeting in the fellowship hall. And and then Friday evening, we have, as I think many of you heard over the weekend, this has kind of been our missions week, and we've been out at the missions conference. And I'll tell you, man, that Marietta, I think it's in danger of burning down, just the fire out there. You walk in the place and it's just on fire. The Lord he's blessing, and it's such an encouragement. And we're going to try to transport it from Marietta right over to here on Saturday morning. But Friday night, as we've been mentioning, we've got this young British actor, evangelist named John Newton Webb, and he's going to do a one-man production on the life of Hudson Taylor. And he did it for us out at the conference last night, and I'm telling you, it is fantastic. So if you want to get blessed, if you want to get challenged, if you want to just get encouraged in your faith, come on out and join us Friday evening at 7 o'clock here in the sanctuary for John Newton Webb. And then Saturday morning, we are having our missions day, and that is really, really exciting. We've got missionaries from all over the place that have come into town. They're going to have, probably out in the courtyard, I think, or in the gym, they're going to have little booths set up where you can kind of get a feel for where they're at, what they're doing, the culture that they're ministering in. We've got some interviews with a half a dozen or so of the missionaries, and just a great time of fellowship. And then John Chubik, who's recently joined our pastoral staff after 18 years on the mission field, John's going to be giving a word, and I know that's going to be great. So come on out this weekend for all of these exciting events. 10 to 12 on Saturday. If you got here at 9, that would probably be good too. All right. Here we are, Genesis chapter 12. Let's have just one more word of prayer real quickly. Lord, thank you that we can meet together to study the word. And thank you, Lord, that this isn't just an intellectual exercise. This isn't just a religious thing that we're going through the motions because we've got to do this. Lord, we are gathered here because we believe that this is your word. And we believe, Lord, that it is your eternal word. And it's living and it's powerful. And it speaks to us today, right into our lives. And so, Lord, we're here tonight to learn more about you. We're here to be instructed in our faith. Lord, we're here to be spoken to personally as well, Lord. So those things that you want to share with us tonight, Lord, may we have an open heart and an ear to hear. In Jesus' name, amen. So, as we come to the 12th chapter, we come to a new section in the book of Genesis. As I have previously mentioned, the book of Genesis is divided by four great events, and then by the lives of four great men. We've already considered those events. Just a reminder, the creation, the fall, the flood, and then the dispersion at Babel. And so now we come to the next section, the division between the four great men, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. As we follow along in this history of redemption, and keep that in mind as we're going through Genesis, and really as we go through the Bible in the historical aspect of it, what the Bible is it's the history of redemption. It's not the history of mankind. It's not the history of civilization. It's not the history of various cultures, although those are touched on to some degree. It is specifically the history of redemption. It is the history of God's work in the world to save mankind. And as we pointed out previously, if we understand it that way, it's going to help us not to get tripped up over, why didn't the Bible talk about this? And well, what about that civilization? And well, I heard that there were these people that did this, and how come the Bible didn't mention that? But if we keep in mind, you know, that it is specifically the history of redemption, we will avoid all that. So we come in this history of redemption now to the life of Abraham, or Abram, as he was originally called. Now, Abraham is, of course, the father of the Jewish nation. He is also the father of the Christian faith. Abraham is the father of the Jewish nation. He is the father of the Christian faith. Now, a mythological version of Abraham was invented and developed by Islam. But historically, there is no connection whatsoever between Abraham and Islam. And I make this point because perhaps you've heard this. I've heard this many times over, and I've seen it in print many times. Abraham is referred to as the father of the three great monotheistic faiths: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And yes, of course, if you talk to Muslims, they will try to lay claim to Abraham, but it's not the historical Abraham. It's a mythological Abraham. They, of course, borrowed Abraham from the scriptures, but then they, as I said, they sort of reinvented him and turned him into a Muslim. So we can dismiss that as mythology. Abraham lived approximately 2000 BC. Approximately 2000 BC. We don't know the exact dates, of course, and you can give or take 100 or in some cases perhaps even 200 years there. So 300 to 500 years have transpired since the flood. 300 to 500 years. Now, in one sense, that doesn't sound like all that long of a period of time, and a lot has developed since the flood. So, you know, on the one hand, it didn't seem like all that long of a period of time, but yet, on the other hand, you know, 300 to 500 years is actually a long time. And so, what has happened since the flood is that the earth has been greatly repopulated. We, of course, saw how God brought that judgment upon man and scattered people all over the earth so that they might be fruitful and multiply as he commanded them to do and fill the earth. And so many nations have developed and civilizations have sprung up. And so we're reading about people who lived in those earliest civilizations. If you pick up a book on world history, a textbook from a classroom, or you go down to Borders and you go to the history rack and you just, you know, pick up a book on world history. Every book on world history starts, after they get through the whole prehistorical thing, which is just speculation, basically, but every history book starts with the what we might call the Babylonian civilization. The kingdoms of Sumer and Akkad. And that civilization that developed in what we would know today as Iraq. And Abraham was a citizen of that particular civilization. And so every history starts with that Babylonian, Sumerian, Akkadian civilization. And then it moves from there to the Egyptian civilization. And hands down, all historians do agree that the Babylonian and the Egyptian were the first two civilizations. Now, of course, we know that there was a civilization that existed prior to that, a massive civilization, but that civilization was obliterated through the flood. So really, history only goes back 6, 8, maybe 10,000 years at the most, recorded history. So Abraham, he was there. He was part of that original civilization. Now, with Abraham, an entirely new period may be said to begin. So in a sense, what's happening here, you know, it's almost sort of a repeat in some senses of what happened after the flood. What did God do with the flood? He destroyed everything with the exception of Noah and his family. And why did God do that? Because man and the earth had become thoroughly corrupted. And because man was so thoroughly corrupted, in order for God to ultimately fulfill his promise that he gave to Adam and Eve back in the garden, that possibility was being jeopardized by human sin. So God destroys man in his sin. He preserves Noah and his family. And essentially, what does God do? He sort of starts over again. But it doesn't take long. And we saw even, you know, shortly after the flood, as we looked at some of the post-flood events with Nimrod and some of the different individuals back then, the rebellion, it didn't take long for that to resurface. And now, 300 years maybe have passed, maybe maximum 500 years, and we're back to the same situation where man, for the most part, has thoroughly corrupted himself. And this man, Abram, he lives in a totally idolatrous society. The city that he lives in is actually the center of the worship of the moon god. And so, once again, God is having to start fresh. But what he does this time is he chooses a man and he is going to create a new race, if you will. He's going to create a new strain within the human family that is going to be committed to him. And the vehicle through which he is going to accomplish His will and the promises that He made all the way back in the garden. So Abraham was to be the ancestor of a new race in whom the divine promises were to be preserved and through whom they would be finally realized. Abram was a Mesopotamian. We, of course, think of him as the father of the Jewish people, and of course, he became that. But Abraham himself, he was not a Jew in the sense that we think of the Jewish people today. He wasn't an Israelite. Of course, his grandson was the one who was named by God Israel. So Abraham was a Mesopotamian. He was a Babylonian. He was from the city of Ur. And as I said, in modern-day Iraq, southern Iraq, if you look on a map today and you look at Basra, we're familiar with Basra. We've heard about it on the news many times. And if you just go a little bit north and a little bit west, you will see Ur. That's the place that Abram was from. And so, as I said, this city was named after the ancient moon god, and it was the center of worship for the Babylonian moon god. And according to Joshua 24, verse 2, Abram's ancestors, including his father Terah, they worshipped other gods, most probably the moon god. Now, I think a lot of times we living in this modern age that we live in, we tend to think of ancient people as, somehow not as intelligent as we are, or not as sophisticated as we are, or not as civilized as we are. And of course, we have this residual effect of evolutionary theory. So the further back you think the more primitive man is, and finally to where you get back to the cave dweller and all of that sort of thing. History and archaeology totally refute those kinds of ideas. The civilization that Abram lived in was a very advanced civilization. And in many ways, those ancient civilizations were very similar to our present civilization, just with a few exceptions. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have some of the advancements in technology that we have. And of course, medical technology and things like that that have developed, they didn't have a lot of that. But it seems that they might have had practices and things that we still don't quite understand. But this man, Abram, he lived in the city of Ur at the height of its splendor. And the city was a prosperous center of religion and industry. And through archaeological excavation, thousands of recovered clay documents or tablets, cuneiform tablets, that have been discovered, they attest to a thriving business community in this city of Ur. And perhaps as many as almost 500,000 people living in that area. So, this is somewhat of a metropolis. Excavations of the royal cemetery have revealed a surprisingly advanced culture, particularly in the arts and crafts. So, this is the background. And, here's something to me that it's so fascinating, because I'm reading about Ur, I'm reading about Abraham, I'm reading about that whole region that we're going to look at here tonight in my Bible today, but I'm also reading about it in my newspaper today as well. It's astounding to me in that it just seems like, everything has come back around to where it all began. And the center of world conflict presently is in the place that we are looking at here in our Bibles tonight. And it's all come back around. And as you know, many of the struggles and problems and the conflicts are rooted in ideas and beliefs that go back thousands of years. So it's amazing. It's astounding to me how current the Bible is. And so, with that little introduction to Abraham, whom we will call Abram for the time being, we begin chapter 12, verse 1. Look what it says. It says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you." So, chapter 12 picks up with telling us that God had spoken already to Abram. Now, if we just go back a few verses into chapter 11, we're going to find out some interesting things. Let me read from verse 27. This is a genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in his native land in Ur of the Chaldeans. Then Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren, she had no child. And Terah, now listen to this, and Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. That's important information right there. Go back to what we're told about Abram. Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, away from your family, and from your father's house, and go to a land that I will show you. It's interesting, when you read in those previous verses, Terah seems to be the one in charge. But what we know from the text here is that it was Abram that God actually had spoken to, and he told him specifically to get out of his father's house. Now, we know, as I mentioned earlier, we know from Joshua that Terah was an idolater. He was an idol worshiper. Now, some have assumed, based on that, that, well, Abram must have been as well. I don't necessarily think so. It could very well be because there were still, individuals here and there who were holding fast to the revelation that had been given by God in the earlier days. And it could very well be that Abram was one of those individuals who was still seeking the true and the living God. But in the New Testament, we're told, in Acts chapter 7, we are told that the God of glory appeared to Abraham while he was living in Mesopotamia. So, again, we don't know any of the details of how this happened, but there came a point in this man's life, in the life of this Mesopotamian, Abram, there came a point where the God of glory, the God of the Bible, the God of Adam and Eve, the God of Noah, after perhaps a prolonged period of silence, this God appears to Abram. And he commissions him. And he tells him specifically that he is to get out of that country. He is to get out of the country. He's to separate from his family. And he is to leave his father's house. But yet, in the previous verses, as we saw, it says that Terah, he took Abram. He took Abram's wife, Sarai. He took his grandson, Lot, and he led them out, going ostensibly to the land of Canaan, but then they end up in Haran. So, you know, here's what we see, I think. Abram, and of course he will become Abraham, we speak of him, and the New Testament speaks of him, as the father of faith. And what we are looking at here is simply the beginning of his journey of faith. And you see, here's the reality. Nobody becomes a great man or woman of faith overnight. Nobody has an instant kind of a faith where they are just, you know, from that moment forward, filled with faith. They never falter. They never waver. They don't have to grow or progress. They just, you know, go from faith to faith to greater faith to greater faith. It doesn't happen like that. It's a process. And the thing about Abram that's so encouraging, I think, as we're going to go through his life, it's encouraging to see how God is so faithful to keep his promises even in the face of human weakness, in the face of human failure, in the face of the great man of faith not having any faith. You know, because sometimes I think we get the wrong impression. I think we think in order for God to do something in our lives, we've got to be perfect in faith. In order for God to do something in our lives, we've got to be, you know, perfectly godly people, always consistently in the Spirit and never doubting and never frustrated and never worried and never angered or anything like that. And you know what? That is simply not a reality. There's never been a person in the world that's ever been like that at all, with the exception of one person, and that we know, of course, is Jesus himself. So we're going to be encouraged, because we're going to see that the father of the faith had his own struggles. And again, I don't know for sure what happened, but I think what we see here immediately is we see the human weakness. God says, get away from your family. Leave your father's house. Get out of your country. And for Abram, this was difficult. Oh, Lord, but my daddy's older. And he, you know, my brother's already died. And I think, here's what I think happened. I could be totally wrong, but I could just imagine this scenario. Abram has this encounter with the living God, this revelation. And he's sure that God has told him to do this, but he goes to his father and he says, Father, the true God, the living God, he has appeared to me. And he's told me that we're to leave here, and he's told me that we're to go to this other place, and he's going to give us this land. He's going to make us a new people. Oh, Father, you don't need to worship these idols. Let's go serve the living God. And I'm sure Terah thought, well, okay, that sounds all right, son. But remember, I'm the dad, so I'll call the shots, and I'll tell you when we're going, and I'll tell you how we're going to get there, and, you know, because I'm in charge. And I think, honestly, that Abram, being human, being just like we are, frail, feeble, sinful, I think this was an area where he just sort of capitulated to Terah. And now here's what happens. God tells him, God tells them to head out, and he says, I'm going to give you clarity on where you're going, and it becomes known to them that they are to go to the land of Canaan. And so they head out, and instead of going to Canaan, they go all the way up north to Haran. And no doubt this had to do with Terah. Now, incidentally, you remember Haran was the name of one of Terah's sons, the son who died. Was that region named after him? Perhaps it was. Perhaps there were other family members there. Again, we don't know any of the details. But I think it's more than a coincidence that his son is named Haran and he goes to the land of Haran. But he goes north. Now, from Ur to Canaan is already about a 500-mile journey. And of course, you know, the way they traveled, that's a long distance and it's going to take a long time. But what Terah does is he takes them to Haran, and they go so far north that if we were to track where they were today, they would have ended up on the border of Turkey and Syria, just slightly on the Turkish side of the border. So they're way up north from where they're supposed to be. And we don't know how long they stayed there, but we know from the record that Terah died there. So we see with Abram, our man of faith, who's spoken to by God, we see that through human weakness, he allows his father to take the lead. He ends up in a distant land, far from where God had originally told him to go. And so, you know, through this act of disobedience, he delays the work of God, and he creates a lot of, I'm sure, unnecessary hardship for himself. Because now he's got to pick up the journey, and he's got to basically backtrack to the south. We can do the same kinds of things. Because, you know, sometimes the Lord will say something to us similar. Sometimes the Lord will call us out of relationships with people. Sometimes he'll call us out of the comfortable. Or sometimes he'll call us out of, you know, the convenient. And he'll say, you know, I want you out of that relationship, or I want you to move from that particular place there, or I want you to disengage from that situation. And we know that it's the right move, and we agree that we should do it, and we're going to do it, but Lord, how about if I do it, you know, like this? And we come up with, you know, sort of an alternation to God's plan. But here's the thing. Whenever we do that, we're just going to create unnecessary hardship for ourselves, and we're going to delay the work of God in our lives. So even though the Lord might at times, you know, give us instruction and give us a command that's going to be maybe difficult emotionally, it might be challenging because, you know, I'm going to have to break off this relationship or something like that. The point is, we need to do it. We need to do it because even though God will, in his grace, he'll be merciful to us and he'll help us to recover, but we will slow down the process of his work in our lives. And we can end up distracted. We can end up stuck in a place. I'm sure when Abram was in Haran, he was probably thinking, what are we doing here? How in the world did we get here? This isn't where God told us to go. And he probably was stuck there for quite a while. So it's important that we obey the specific instruction that God gives us. So the call of God contains also the promise of God's blessing as we go on and read. And this is what God said to him as he appeared to him and spoke to him. Not only was he to leave his country and his family and go to this land, but God says, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you, and in you all of the families of the earth shall be blessed. So God just appears to this man and he says, I'm going to start a whole new thing and I'm going to do it with you. And even though he was temporarily sidetracked because he allowed his human emotion to overrule what he actually should have done, God is faithful. But look real quickly at the promise that God gave him. He said, first of all, I will make you a great nation. God says, I'm going to bring into existence a whole new nation, and I'm going to do it with you. I'm going to start with you, you and your wife. He said, and you personally, I will bless you. I will give you a great name. I think arguably the name of Abraham is one of the greatest in all of history. I mean, here we are, thousands of years later, talking about him. How many people are being talked about tonight after they've been off the scene for thousands of years, or hundreds of years, or a few decades even? So we can see that God's actually done that. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. You shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. So God promises to Abraham, I am going to bless you. I am going to prosper you. I am going to protect and defend and fight for you. And then, and in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Abraham is to be the progenitor of the Savior of the world. That's what God reveals to him. He is going to create a new nation through which he can fulfill his promise of sending the Messiah into the world. And so, verse 4 picks up after the temporary detour to Haran. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Then Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh, and the Canaanites were in the land. So they make this long, long journey from all the way up north, and they come to Shechem. They come to the area of Samaria. What we would know today as the West Bank. This is the region that they call the West Bank. And that is the place that Abram came to. And notice the little note that the Canaanites were in the land. Now, the Canaanites were an extremely wicked people as well. So remember, he's called to go out of Ur of the Chaldees, where there's just blatant idolatry. he's called to go to Canaan, where things aren't really morally or spiritually any better off, but God is sending him there because eventually he is going to uproot and cast the Canaanites out of the land, and he's going to give the land to Abraham and to his descendants. And so now, as he has arrived in the land, then the Lord appeared to Abram and said. So it would seem that from that initial revelation that God had given until now, there had not been any further revelation or instruction. And there's a principle there. And I think the principle has application to us today. We have got to do what God tells us to do before we can expect him to tell us what else to do or the next thing to do. We've got to do the first thing. And a lot of times, you know, we don't want to do that. Well, Lord, I'll do this, but tell me the rest. Well, Lord, just show me where this is going and then I'll do it. But it doesn't work that way. You see, this is the way it works. And this is the way God works. God rarely, if ever, gives us any kind of a detailed picture of the future. I've certainly found that in my life. God will give you just sort of a sense of something, but I have found that he will reserve the details for himself. You know, I think of Paul the Apostle. Paul, in the epistle to the Romans, right at the end there, he says to them, in writing to them, he says, Now pray for me, I want to come to you. And then he lays out his plan. I'm going to come to you, and this is how I'm going to do it, and I'm confident that it's going to happen. And the Lord is going to get me there, and you know, I'm going to see you. And Paul was right. He was going to Rome. And he had been given that sense from the Lord that yes, Rome is a destination that I'm going to go there, and the Lord has a work for me there. So he had that sense, but he didn't know any of the details about how it was going to happen. As a matter of fact, when you read what he said, he thought it was going to happen one way, and it happened an entirely different way. And I guarantee, had God told him in advance the way it was going to happen, Paul would have said, you know what, I don't need to go to Rome. I'm fine right here. You send somebody else over there. And, you know, I think a lot of times the Lord will withhold some of that information from us because he knows if he told us, we wouldn't do it. So he gives us a general picture and he calls us to take the step. But it's only when I take the step that then he reveals the next step. And so now, after a season of and disobedience, but I don't want to, you know, disobedience in a light sense. I don't want to paint Abram as this, you know, rebellious, disobedient. He wasn't that at all. It was through weakness. Like I said, his love for his father, for his family. But nevertheless, it was a form of disobedience. But after he's through that, and he follows through with God, what God commands him to do, we come now back to the place of revelation once again. And so now he's in Canaan, and the Lord appeared to him and said, to your descendants I will give this land. And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. So notice, this is now an addition to the promise that God had given. The promises included, remember, making his name great, making him a blessing, blessing him and cursing those who cursed him, being the progenitor of the Messiah. And now, and this is going to become more and more defined as we go on, but now God makes it clear, to your seed, descendants in my Bible, but literally to your seed, I will give this land. Now, that's important. It's important today because there's a war going on right now, because there's a whole lot of people in that region who do not want the descendants, the natural descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to have the land that God gave them. And they're fighting to kick them out. So again, we see that this, you know, this isn't irrelevant ancient history we're talking about. This is current. Because that conflict over there goes back to this promise right here. God says, I'm going to give to your seed this land. And Abram built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel. And he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram journeyed going on still toward the south. Now, we're going to see this with Abram. He is, above everything else, Abram is a worshiper of God. Now, think of this. Abram doesn't go to church. He doesn't have a church. There's no such thing as a church. He doesn't have a Bible. He might very well have the records that have been passed down from the previous generations about the work of God. But he is a worshiper of God. You know, sometimes we think of worship almost exclusively in terms of singing songs to God. And we are so set in that mode that that's what we refer to when we're singing. Okay, well, we're going to have a time of worship and then we'll have a Bible study and, you know. But really, worship in the Bible, the picture of worship in the Bible is not singing a song or two here or there, although that certainly can be part of it. But the picture of worship in the Bible is a life that is given over to the Lord. That's the sacrifice that becomes that acceptable form of worship. And that's what Paul says in Romans 12, you remember. Present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service, is one translation. But another translation is, which is your spiritual act of worship. And both translations are legit. Which is your spiritual act of worship. So a worshiper of God is a person who presents themselves to God in obedience to God, surrendering their life to God for His use, for His glory, for His purpose. And that's what Abram was. And he manifested that by building altars. Wherever he went, he would build an altar to express what was in his heart to the Lord, to express that worship. So he continued journeying south. So Bethel and Ai, if you were to look at a map, again, Shechem would be in the center of the country, north of Jerusalem. Bethel is further south, sort of east, southeast of Jerusalem a bit. And now he's continuing to go south in the land. But verse 10 tells us, now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. Now listen to what happens. This is our man of faith. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore, for it will happen when the Egyptians see you, that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me. But they will let you live. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. Now, it's interesting that this was not an unfounded fear. There was recovered in an excavation a tablet that spoke of an Egyptian king who sent his army out to kill a man specifically because he wanted her wife, about the same time that Abram lived. So, you know, it's not a totally unfounded fear. And, as we're going to find out a little bit later, but I'll let you in on the secret already, Sarai was, he wasn't totally lying. She was his half-sister. And that'll come out later. But here he says, let's be brother and sister. We can be husband and wife later. Right now, let's be brother and sister. That's more advantageous for my well-being. And so she agrees to do it. And so it was when Abram came into Egypt that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. Of course, they would have a harem, and so she would be a candidate to join the harem. He treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys, and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because Sarai, Abram's wife, and Pharaoh, because of Sarai, Abram's wife, and Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way." So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot went with them to the south. Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold, and he went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there at first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. So notice we see again that Abram is in the school of faith and he's learning lessons. And as is sometimes the case, you learn lessons the hard way by doing the wrong thing and having to live with certain consequences and you know, progress through that method. There's a famine in the land. God says to Abram, go to the land of Canaan. God didn't say go to Egypt. He said go to Canaan. So he comes to Canaan, but there's a famine in the land. And notice, there's no record of Abram praying. There's no record of him asking God wisdom or advice or direction. He simply assumes that because there's a famine in the land, we need to go down to Egypt because there's food there. So again, he's sort of, you know, stumbling his way through. His faith is weak. He's not trusting God. And then when he gets down to Egypt, he's not trusting God. He's worried, he's afraid for his life. You know, he very well could have been jeopardizing Sarai's life. But notice what happens. As soon as he can, he gets out of there and he gets right back to where he was before. And he goes right back to what he had previously been doing. He goes back to worshiping. He goes back to Bethel. By the way, Bethel means the house of God. So there was that place of God's presence was evidently there. And so we see him that he kind of, you know, ventures out on his own. And again, this is what we do sometimes as well. The Lord is speaking to us and he's leading us and we move out and we have some success and we're obedient and we begin to experience his blessing, and then something else comes up and we just say, oh, well, you know, hey, that looks good, or, well, I don't need to pray about that. I can, of course, just, anybody knows that that's the right thing to do. And so we just launch out without consulting the Lord, and then what happens? We find ourselves in trouble. And God is merciful. He's gracious. He, you know, might let us get roughed up a little bit just to teach us a lesson. But he soon restores us, brings us back. We come to our senses and say, oh, Lord, I can't believe that I did that. I can't believe that I didn't pray about that. Now, again, this is the kind of thing that, you know, we might do this stuff to some extent all of our lives. We're growing all of our lives. We're learning through all of our lives. But the wonderful thing in all of that to me is the patience of God with human weakness. You see, God doesn't write us off. He doesn't say, okay, that's it. You didn't pray about it. So you're out. I'm finished. I'm sick and tired of you not praying and seeking my counsel and going out on your own, getting yourself in trouble and having to get you out of it. I'm finished with you. You know, the wonderful thing is God doesn't do that. Because God's our Father. And like a good father, what does He do? Well, He corrects us. He works with us. I remember times when my kids were younger and I would spank them. And I would immediately, after I spanked them, spend the next 5 minutes at least hugging them. Because I wanted them to know that even though I was disciplining them and needed to discipline them, that I loved them. And the same is true with God. And, you know, the thing that I feel that so often we don't realize it as Christians. We get this image of God in our head. We think of God as anxious to judge. We think of Him as impatient and easily angered, easily irritated. And, you know, if we've slipped up in any way, He's just waiting for an opportunity to chastise us, or in some instances just to, you know, disregard us, just get rid of us. And that is so far from the picture of God that we have in the Bible. And the beautiful thing about the lives of these patriarchs is that we see how God works with people, and He works with human weakness, and we see that the life of faith is a life of growing and developing in our faith. And so, just know that. Know that. That God is patient. And those promises He's given you, He's going to fulfill those promises. He's called us to certain things in order to help bring those promises along. God has spoken many things to me, given me many promises, and told me, okay, now this is what I'm going to do. Now you do this, and okay, I'll do it. And then I find that I'm not doing it, and I'm frustrated, and I'm impatient, and then I'm complaining and murmuring. And, you know, God has said, okay, forget it. I'm not going to do that now. I take it back. The Lord just says, no, Brian, you need to learn to quit murmuring. You need to learn to just wait patiently for me. And I find in my own life, the Lord just keeps coming back. And sometimes, you know, it's the same lesson over and over again. Okay, here I am again. Yes, Lord, for the 500th time, I'm going to pray this prayer again. But you know what? He's there. And He is patient. And He will keep working with us. As long as we come and just say, Lord, I've blown it. And like I said, I'm sure when Abram was in Haran, I'm sure he was thinking, oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I let my dad lead this thing. And I'm stuck. And this isn't where I'm supposed to be. And God knew all of that. It's all right. Just, you know, let's get moving again. Goes down to Egypt. And can you imagine how he felt when Pharaoh's rebuking him? The great man of faith, the great man of God, is being rebuked by a pagan king. He must have been thinking to himself, oh, I can't believe I did this. Oh, Lord, forgive me for not praying. What am I doing in Egypt? I'm not supposed to be in Egypt. How did I do that to Sarai? What was I thinking? Oh, God. It's all right, Abram. Let's go back up to Bethel. And just the patient, continual work of grace in our lives. And that's the God that we serve. The God of glory that appeared to Abraham while he was in Mesopotamia, that's the God we serve. The way God worked in his life is the way he works in our lives. And so be encouraged by that. And as we continue to go through, I was hoping to get further tonight, but as we continue to go through, we're going to see that he is just, you know, it's a lot of ways, it's just one lesson after another. But he's going to grow, and his faith is going to become stronger. And the test will get more severe. But God is faithful, and he will pass the test. God is faithful, and we will pass the test as well. Let's pray.